Coming up on Path to Zero,
the Inflation Reduction Act and the incentives that are baked in there have really helped make things like hydrogen and carbon capture, sort of those next generation climate sectors, much more investable and financeable.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hi, Path to Zero listeners. You know, there's no doubt the financial markets are going to have a big impact in the fight against climate change. Our guest in this episode of Path to Zero covers how investors are financing the transition to clean energy for the Wall Street Journal. Amrith Ramkumar is the climate finance reporter for the Journal. It's great to have you today, Amrith. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I'm a lover of the Wall Street Journal. I read it every day, and I think it says a whole lot about the importance of the finance around climate change that the Wall Street Journal dedicates a reporter to covering it. Talk to us about your interest in taking on this beat.
Sure, I would definitely agree. I've been in this job that we call climate finance for about 9 months now, and it definitely speaks to how important capital markets will be to channeling the trillions of dollars to fighting climate change. So I've been at the Journal now for about 5.5 years. My first beat was covering financial markets, so that included a lot of different things, including battery metals like lithium and cobalt. So the battery supply chain was when I started doing my first climate reporting, probably in like 2017, 2018 time period. And then I started covering SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, also called blank check companies. They're an alternative to traditional initial public offerings. So I started doing that late in 2020, and they had a big moment, a boom and a bust with a lot of climate startups. All of that to say, I've been doing a lot of climate reporting for several years, but I officially became the Journal's first climate finance reporter early this year. And yeah, to your point, the topic is too large to ignore. We need dedicated people in our newsroom and others covering it in a smart way, in a clear way. So it's very fun. Yeah, I get to do a lot with private market transactions, how startups are raising money, the new areas like hydrogen, carbon capture, things like that. So there's definitely a lot of activity and a lot to talk about with things like ESG.
And it really does all start with finance and those ideas. Let me go back, because you said it yourself, and I really wanted to compliment you on the article that you wrote recently about companies that are recycling batteries, and you really tied it into the Inflation Reduction Act, and it was just a really well-written article. What would you kind of share with our listeners maybe your takeaways when you were researching that story?
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Yeah, battery recycling has been something I've been interested in for several years, ever since, going back to 2017, 2018. As I've written more about lithium and the battery supply chain, there are just these massive, massive shortages of raw materials that I don't think people truly appreciate. If you think about how much metal it takes to build enough batteries to go into one EV, let alone thousands or millions, we're just talking about oceans and oceans full of raw materials. So recycling is a huge part of that solution. If you can figure out ways to take end of life EV batteries and recycle those materials. The problem is it's never really been done on a large scale, because we're basically in the first generation of EV batteries that won't be recycled for several years. So it's a classic chicken and egg problem that comes up with a lot of clean energy technology, where companies need to invest in large scale lithium ion battery recycling facilities and manufacturing and technology now, but they won't actually make money at scale for several years. So recycling is also part of the solution, but it can't fully meet our metal needs. So there's also a need for new mining and processing in the Western world, in the US and Europe outside China. But of course, all new mines face local opposition due to concerns about environmental damage or construction disruptions. So all of those raw materials challenges and possible solutions are really fascinating and a big storyline to watch for sure.
It was just a great article. And let me just kind of build on your experience just as you report this. You know, again, I think you have hit right to the essence of electrification for electrification to be successful, I think we've got to figure out a way to store energy, and batteries are the more obvious way, right? I mean, so, and I don't think people realize the complexity of a battery. Now, I'm quick to say the end game here is using a battery that's not even been conceived yet. The materials, the way we store it, it's not even in the back hall of a laboratory yet. But you know, as we talk about bringing electrification into America, we have to bring better batteries. I just don't see a place for minerals and mining to enter the American economy much. Do you? Just because it is so, it's so land intense, it's so water intense, it's labor intense, and it's everything probably against what we stand for in terms of EPA and OSHA. I mean, do you see it a different way?
I have a slightly different take. I do. I think startups like Lilac Solutions and others are really working on things like direct lithium extraction and sort of the next generation mining techniques that could be done with lower emissions footprints and using modern day technology. So I think if there are the right projects, the right breakthroughs, you do kind of need a whole suite of solutions, regardless of the batteries of the future. They probably will need some raw materials that will need to be mined. And I think we're in a very dangerous place where China dominates the supply chain for batteries. And as we're finding out with the war in Ukraine and what's going on with fossil fuel shortages, that's very dangerous when you depend solely on one or two countries for so many critical materials. So I do think it will be kind of this whole suite of solutions that address the raw materials problem. But I do think mining has to be part of that in North America, and people need to have hard, nuanced conversations about the projects with the best emissions and energy and water profiles that might actually have a chance at moving forward. It's definitely a tough one for sure, though. And I think at the beginning, you were talking about zooming out and saying the role electrification plays in a broad decarbonization strategy. I think one reason people are so excited about things like hydrogen and e-fuels and some of the stuff that could be used to decarbonize shipping and trucking is because they're realizing you can't electrify everything, and raw material shortages are part of the reason why.
Yeah, you know, I'm hoping we were the originator of the wide path theory, that the path to a clean climate is not through a narrow single choice called electrification. It's through a wide path that still gives us a path towards decarbonization. I know I'm just back from a conference really on the climate, and what I heard over and over was, you know, we're supportive of a wide path theory as long as there is a vision to get to zero carbon. And I thought that's kind of such a nice change in the narrative now, because as you say, I mean, electrofuels, you mentioned it themselves, we've been working on renewable fuels for probably 4 or 5 years, and electrofuels are so popular now. But again, a classic example of the kind of that wide path series of solutions that gets us to a cleaner climate. All right, I'm going to walk right into that, what you said, because you sit at the heart of New York, you're in the middle of the investment world. Now, what are the trends you see that are financeable today? What are the big picture trends that are really attracting capital investment?
Sure. I think it's a much different conversation post-Inflation Reduction Act, and the incentives that are baked in there have really helped make things like hydrogen and carbon capture, sort of those next generation climate sectors, much more investable and financeable. So there are these climate mega funds that are sitting on billions of dollars of private money, and they're looking to put it to work. So they're pumping money into those startups. Then of course you have the more developed technologies, wind and solar, that are more about scaling. So people are really still pumping money into all of those despite the turmoil hitting the stock market. So clean energy has held up pretty well by those standards, and companies are still raising a lot of money through green bonds and sustainability linked bonds. And big companies are also thinking about ways they can play in these markets. So there's still just this flood of capital going into that suite of solutions. But hydrogen and carbon capture, so carbon capture at the source of factories, and carbon removal, directly removing it from the air, those are definitely kind of the next areas that a lot of investors I talk to are very excited about. And the big names are starting to think about how they can put money in, when they'll scale, and all of that sort of stuff. So the IRA was really a game changer for some of that, because it includes tax credits for up to a decade. and for, or it cements them for a decade, basically. So for things like hydrogen that make no economic sense when you're talking about green hydrogen or hydrogen made from natural gas using carbon capture, now you can start to map out and do the math and say, hey, this is something I can invest in. So the mood is surprisingly upbeat, I would say, among a lot of investors I talk to, considering the carnage hitting many other segments of the economy right now.
Yeah, and of course, you didn't mention it exactly, but nuclear, small-scale nuclear.
Absolutely. That's
fusion,
what I missed. Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I've seen more money flowing into fusion than we have in a long time. Amrith, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today with Amrith Ronkumar, climate finance reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I'm more of a technologist than anything. I really believe that technology will be, you know, a provider of so many of these solutions. And a lot of people in early on, this was a war against big oil, big gas, because the view, I guess, being that they were part of the problem. How on earth could they be a part of the solution? But you said again, I know you see a lot of entrepreneurial ideas. So let me just kind of give you my hypothesis, and then you can tell me whether you agree or not. Certainly the solutions can come from the smallest, you know, single person companies with a great idea. But at the end of the day, the problems are of such scale and magnitude that they're going to probably be executed by large corporations that can have the attraction to capital and to finance and to staff. So it's a world where, yes, entrepreneurs have a major role in providing the ideas, but at the end of the day, the solutions are probably look like big oil and gas executing the solutions. Do you tend to agree with that, or do you find a wrinkle in that story?
I agree with that 100%. And I think what we've seen in electric vehicles kind of bears that out, right? Where you have Tesla and Elon Musk kind of out in front in a lot of ways, then the big legacy players, Ford, GM, others, see that that's the wave of the future, and then they jump on it. And now when you're talking about actually this full scale of electrification, it is the big companies that will end up driving a lot of that along with Tesla and other startups. And I think that's a playbook that we'll continue to see in these emerging areas, especially when you're thinking about things like hydrogen and carbon capture, when you're talking about working with chemicals or putting things underground. The people that know how to do that have been trained for decades in the energy sector. And so it's a bit naive, I think, a lot of environmentalists want to say divest from fossil fuel companies and make them go away. I think it's hard to say that $300-400 billion market cap companies are going to disappear in just a few years. These companies are not stupid. They see the writing on the wall. They see the long-term projections for oil and gas demand, and they're looking for ways to pivot their business. So I think when you're talking about building infrastructure at scale and the amount of money and expertise that takes, big companies definitely have a lot to offer in that regard. But I think to your point, like, startups are very important for also getting some of the new tech out there and pushing the envelope forward. And we've seen that with something like hydrogen, where I think people have seen companies like Plug Power and some of the startups really taking on the incumbent gas companies in that space. And how that dynamic unfolds will be fascinating, because there will be a few winners and many losers, as is the case with electric vehicles.
Yeah, really well said. So let's stay on that theory about oil and gas. I know you recently wrote about how investors are still finding their way towards oil and gas. Are you seeing that investment continuing, or do you see it tend to be cooling off?
I think it's best described as they're sort of holding on for dear life to their existing oil and gas assets that are making money, right? So the ratio of fundraising for oil and gas companies through the debt markets to green financing is about 1-to-1 right now. So you can kind of look at it as big oil and gas companies still need to function, still need to supply something like 80% of the world's energy. So investors help them raise money. They know that they can't shut that spigot off today or tomorrow, but they are at the same time, again, pumping money into these startups. So they're holding on to those assets in the fossil fuel sector, but they're also telling those companies, you need to think about the future, you need to clean up your act, and we need to kind of chart that wide path to a net zero future if we can. So it's an ideal mix for investors right now because they're able to quietly hold on to these profitable oil and gas assets while playing up all the good they're allegedly doing with their green startup or other green investments. So everyone's trying to kind of walk that narrow path and balance the two. And it's gotten a lot harder given a lot of the rhetoric these days about things like ESG, environmental, social, and governance investing, and how that might constitute divestment from fossil fuels. Despite what's been out there, no major investment firm or bank is really divesting from fossil fuels. They're just trying to balance their investments and think about the long-term future, which is what they've done for decades.
And it's not lost on me either that not only EIA's forecast for oil and gas, but most of the world agencies' forecast show it continuing to rise through 2040, maybe even to 2050, depending on the agency. They don't show the same rate of growth, but they also don't show any decline in oil and gas, which to me is something that's not been talked about very much in environmental circles, but it's out there for you just to see that there's not a strong prediction that oil and gas is going to decline in volume.
Right. It's all about how can we produce lower carbon oil and gas, I would say, and actually roll up our sleeves and do the hard work, which is what eventually all of this comes down to, right? I think too often we demonize certain segments of the economy and certain solutions, and we put others up on pedestals. Like electric vehicles, for example, I would argue people in some cases think that we're going to electrify everything and then we're done, even though depending on what math you look at, they might only be something like 20 to 30% of the decarbonization solutions. So I think what you're talking about is the other thing, the kind of dirty secret that, again, the world still needs a lot of oil and gas, and producers have to figure out how they can make those fossil fuels with a lower footprint and responsibly while transitioning their businesses. So that definitely requires some hard, nuanced conversations that are often lacking.
Yes, well said. So you mentioned electrofuels. Let's stay with that, or e-fuels. You know, there had been quite a bit of pushback, I think, that there's no such thing as renewable diesel or sustainable aviation fuel, that renewable liquid fuels are in fact still not positive for the environment. Yet you now begin to see, you know, a breadth of companies coming out with very low carbon, maybe carbon negative even, renewable fuels. You a believer in renewable liquid fuels?
It's a tough question. I think, again, it comes back to scale. I haven't really seen too many projects that are being executed at a large scale yet with a long runway. So I think for a lot of those renewable fuels, they're using fats, oils, and greases. And that's been good to get off the ground and show it can be done. But in the future, things people are talking about using like trash or plant waste and some of those other basically inputs to make those renewable fuels. So I think it's, again, all about the math and how those processes work at scale and how good they end up being for the environment, to your point. But I'm, again, of the belief that we just need all of those solutions for the hard to abate sectors. With things like that, you're talking about a ton of input material needed to make a tiny amount of sustainable aviation fuel or renewable diesel. So we need all of it. We need all of the green hydrogen. We need all of those solutions. And then they need to be scaled to even get close to what's needed to avoid the worst of the climate crisis. So I think it's a bit premature to say one of these solutions will be better than the other for the longer term, like long duration trucking, shipping, all of that stuff. No one's figured out how to do any of it at scale and make a dent. So I think the battle between all of those and hydrogen and some of these other technologies will be fascinating. But again, to that point, you can't really electrify air travel or some of these long distance shipping routes. So that's why these breakthroughs are so important.
Right. Yeah. I don't think you can really electrify agriculture, you know, using modern batteries. You'll be able to electrify agriculture with the battery of 2070, perhaps. But yeah, well said. So let's have a little bit of fun. We love to have a little bit of fun on this podcast. And before we really get into the normal fun of magic wands and trees, you're a Duke grad. And of course, we always love a Duke grad, but I'll give you a chance to kind of talk about what you learned at Duke. And maybe I love your perspective on either Coach K leaving, or you can even talk about the new powerhouse called Duke football now. What would you like to tell us about your time at Duke?
Yeah, that's funny that you're happy to have a Duke grad on. I feel like a lot of people are anti-Duke for obvious reasons. But yeah, it's funny. I was born and raised in Norman, Oklahoma. So my dad's a professor at the University of Oklahoma in aerospace and mechanical engineering. And so, yeah, born and raised there. Wanted to go to law school when I was deciding where to go to college. So I spurned OU, which was, again, 15 minutes from my house where my dad and a lot of friends taught. And it would have been a lot cheaper for my parents, frankly, to go to Duke because I, again, wanted to go to law school, wanted to be away from home, experience something new. But then I got to Duke. I started writing for the student paper covering sports because I was a huge sports fan, and then fell in love with journalism, which is kind of ironic because OU has an amazing journalism school that was in my backyard that I never really even looked at. But yeah, I fell in love with writing about sports. I actually covered Duke basketball. It's kind of how I got my start in journalism for the student paper, The Chronicle, then became editor in chief and got very into it. But yeah, covering Coach K and Duke basketball was a good way to learn about how to do journalism and some of the challenges you face when people are a little combative or not that revealing in some of their answers, and how to still write interesting stories and find characters and go about it. So I loved it. And yeah, just personally as a fan, it's tough that Coach K had to hang it up, but he had such a good run. And after 40 plus years, I mean, it was time to hand the reins over to someone a bit younger, I think. And you can kind of tell there's a new energy now and some new ideas, and someone in their 30s who's really hungry to show what they can do, I think, is never a bad thing. So yeah, we'll see how it plays out. And Duke football, yeah, I covered my fair share of Duke football games and all of Duke sports, not just basketball. And it's good to see Duke football also doing well again. And they also just got a new coach after the longtime coach and legend David Cutcliffe retired. So I think it's, again, a good lesson that everyone struggles with, right? Like when to hang it up, when to pass it on to the next generation, and make way for others. So
just a great balance. A great balance there, I think, of excellence in academics and an effort to be excellent in sports too. It's kind of a neat place. I'm sure it was great to go there. All right, let's have some fun with the magic wand. Now, this is the place we use a little bit of magic. You can use your wand one time to change one thing in the next year. So lots of ones in there. One time, one thing, one year. That you think would benefit us regarding climate change and sustainability. How are you going to use that wand?
This is a bit selfish, but I would just say just have more nuanced conversations about all of this, because that's what I spend my time doing. That's all the emails I get, and that's all the calls I have. But I think too often our conversations about climate change are not grounded in reality, and you have, again, people trying to demonize the other side, grab headlines, or do all this sort of stuff. And I think for actual progress, you need to fully take a step back, understand the data, understand what you're talking about, and do all of that. So it sounds kind of lame, but I would hope that things like the need for more mining and raw materials in North America and Europe, I would hope that would be a more nuanced conversation than trying to just slap a headline out there that might not be grounded in reality. So I think if we do that, we have a much better chance of all actually understanding these issues and hopefully fighting climate change.
That is a great use of your wand. Let me do ask to that end, because it's something that I have questioned for so long, and I still no closer to the answer today than I was 2 years ago. It's a very complex issue of kind of how we make energy, how we use energy, how we transport energy, impact of using transporting on the environment. And you are correct. It's an emotional argument that actually eventually is highly technical, and people's lives are impacted by the cost of energy, the cleanliness of energy, where they live relative to where energy is made. Why do you think the conversation is so nuanced, and rarely do we get a chance to talk about it across that broad spectrum of not only technology and economics, but society and human change. Why is the conversation so nuanced everywhere?
I think to your point, like, this is just very complex infrastructure when you think about how we get oil and gas out of the ground, and then how it's refined and turned into fuels, and then how it's transported all over the world, and then it goes into your car or your airplane or whatever the case might be. And I think it's very easy for people to look at others and point the finger and blame them for the climate crisis, rather than look at their own lives and what they do and the people around them and the choices they make or the company they work for. So I think that's part of it. But to your point, everyone is sort of guilty of this greenwashing, right? Everyone wants to point the finger at big companies and governments who, again, let's be clear, they have done some terrible stuff over the years, misleading about the role that burning fossil fuels and the damage that does to the environment. But everyone wants to demonize them for greenwashing without, again, rolling up their sleeves and making the hard choices about their own life and maybe paying more for more sustainable products or whatever the case might be. So I think, again, it's a lot easier to point out the nuance elsewhere and not look inward, but that's often what needs to happen for companies, big organizations, and all of that. And I think another thing I've learned talking to some of the smartest academics who have done a lot of research on these things is so much of solving the climate crisis is about how big organizations function. And too often they're grounded in their old ways and roots, and they're not willing to change, and they haven't been able to come to grips with a lot of the realities. So it can be that simple in many cases.
Yeah, thanks for that. Thanks for that, because it really is one of the biggest questions for me as to why we are not able to have, you know, a more honest conversation about not only the choices we're making, but the cost of those choices and the benefits or not of those solutions. So, Amrit, one more thing we love to do is we love to plant a tree in a national forest in recognition of your time and of your effort here today. And listening to you, it's clear you grew up in Oklahoma, spent a little time in North Carolina. You're in New York now. So you got lots of geography to pick from. But do you have a favorite national forest that we should plant a tree in your name?
I don't. That's very kind of you. I'll leave it to you all to decide. But that's a very cool concept, and glad you do it.
Well, we might go to Oklahoma for that, just because there's so many great things going on in Oklahoma these days. All right, before we let you go, anything else you'd like our listeners to know about some work you're doing at the Journal, or anything interesting you're working on, something coming up soon?
That's a tough one. No, I think there's a lot of, it's a fascinating moment right now this year toward the end of 2022. People made these bold proclamations in Glasgow at COP26 last November, basically a year ago. And a year later, they're learning how hard it is to actually get to net zero. And they're having to do the math and do the work. And I think a lot of big companies and big financial institutions didn't realize, frankly, how hard it's going to be. So you have the war in Ukraine showing us the dangers of just cutting off fossil fuels and how dependent we are and how hard it is to quickly shift away. So I think people are kind of balancing those negatives against the positives, things like the Inflation Reduction Act. Again, a lot of the private sector funding that's still there, a lot of the promising technologies. So it's definitely a very interesting one, and it'll be fascinating to see how the next few months go.
Well, I didn't mention, but I would encourage our listeners to go and read the article you wrote about solar energy triggering a boom in sheep herding. Really, perhaps my favorite article written in the last couple of years. Just a fascinating, you know, story of human interest, but how we do have to evolve in this new world as we get to a cleaner climate. So how do our people find you? They can find you at the Wall Street Journal. They can find you on Twitter, I take it. Where do you want them to find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Amrit Ramkumar, or my email is just firstname.lastname@wsj.com, amrit.ramkumar@wsj.com. And yeah, I always love hearing from people and chatting about this stuff, as you can tell. So please don't hesitate.
Well, look, we have really benefited from your reporting. I'm so glad you stepped over to kind of cover the finance portion of that. And thanks for your time today. Thanks for your writing in the Wall Street Journal. And thanks for being our guest and being here with us on Path to Zero. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.